His hopes for an invasion of Pennsylvania, the destruction of the Susquehanna Bridge, the descent on Philadelphia, Baltimore, or the Union capital. Gone, too, was his hope of relieving Maryland of what he called her foreign yoke. Outnumbered worse than 4-1, this half of the army, which in fact was barely more than a third, 14 brigades out of the total 40, would have to retreat across the Potomac, and the other half would have to abandon its delayed convergence on Harper's Ferry. For Jackson and Walker, this would not be difficult, but McLaws was already in the gravest danger. Soon after nightfall, Lee sent him a message admitting defeat. "The day has gone against us, and this army will go by Sharpsburg and cross the river. It is necessary for you to abandon your position tonight." McLaws, of course, would not be able to do this over the Ferry Bridge, which was held by the Federal garrison. He would have to cross the Potomac farther upstream. Lee urged him, however, to do this somewhere short of Shepherdstown, which was just in rear of Sharpsburg. He wanted that ford clear for his own command, which would be retreating with McClellan's victorious army hard on its heels. The evacuation began with Hill, followed by Longstreet. The cavalry brought up the rear. Obliged to abandon his dead and many of his wounded there on the mountain where they had fallen, Lee did not announce that he intended to withdraw across the Potomac, nor did he tell the others that he had instructed McLaws to abandon Maryland Heights. But news that arrived while the retreat was just getting underway confirmed the wisdom, indeed the necessity, of his decision. Crampton's Gap, 6 miles south, had been lost by the troopers sent to defend it, which not only meant that the Federals were pouring through directly in rear of McLaws, but also that they were closer to Sharpsburg than Hill and Longstreet were. Unable to count any longer on McClellan's accustomed caution and hesitation, Lee saw that the march would have to be hard and fast, encumbered though he was with all his trains, if he was to get there first. Whereupon, with the situation thus at its worst and his army in graver danger of piecemeal annihilation than ever, Lee displayed for the first time a side to his nature that would become more evident down the years. He was not only no less audacious in retreat than in advance, but he was also considerably more pugnacious, like an old gray wolf wanting nothing more than half a chance to turn on whoever or whatever tried to crowd him as he fell back. And presently he got it. It came in the form of a message from Jackson, to whom Lee had been sending couriers with information of the latest developments. "Through God's blessing," Stonewall had written at 8:15 p.m. from Bolivar Heights, "the advance, which commenced this evening, has been successful thus far, and I look to him for complete success tomorrow. Your dispatch respecting the movements of the enemy and the importance of concentration has been received." To Lee, this represented a chance to retrieve the situation. By the shortest route, Harper's Ferry was only a dozen miles from Sharpsburg. If the place fell tomorrow, that would mean that a part at least of the besieging force could join him north of the Potomac tomorrow night. For when Jackson said that instructions had been received, he meant that they would be obeyed. McLaws, too, might give the Federals the slip and march northwest without crossing the river. Accordingly, while Hill and Longstreet pushed on westward unpursued, Lee sent couriers galloping southward through the darkness. Unless the Army of the Potomac got into position for an all-out attack on Sharpsburg tomorrow, which seemed doubtful despite McClellan's recent transformation, for one thing there would be no more lost orders, the Army of Northern Virginia would not return to native ground without the shedding of a good deal more blood, Union and Confederate, than had been shed on South Mountain. McLaws was a methodical man, not given to indulging what little imagination he had, and in this case, his present dangers being what they were, with McClellan's left wing coming down on his rear through Crampton's Gap, that was preferable. A 41-year-old Georgian, rather burly, with a bushy head of hair and a beard to match, he had been 4 months a major general. Yet except for commanding 2 brigades under Magruder during the 7 days, had seen no previous service with Lee's army. Now he had 10 brigades, his own 4 and Anderson's 6, and he had been given the most critical assignment in the convergence on Harper's Ferry. Maryland Heights was the dominant one of the three. If the place was to be made untenable, it would be his guns that would do most to make it so. His march from Frederick had been deliberate, so much so that he was a day late in approaching his objective, after which he spent another day brushing federal detachments off the hilltop, and a night cutting a road in order to manhandle his guns up the side of the mountain. At last, 2 days late, he got them into position on the morning of September 14th, and opened wigwag communications with Jackson and Walker across the way. Northward, up the long ridge of South Mountain, D.H. Hill's day-long battle rumbled and muttered, but McLaws, having posted three brigades in that direction to protect his rear, kept his mind on the business of getting his high-perched guns laid in time to open a plunging fire on the ferry whenever Stonewall, who was a day late and still completing his dispositions, gave the signal. During the afternoon, a much nearer racket broke out northward, but whatever qualms McLaws felt at the evidence that his rear guard was under attack were eased by Stuart, who had ridden down from Turner's Gap. The bluecoats in front of Crampton's Gap did not amount to more than a brigade, he said, and McLaws turned back to his guns. Presently, though, as the noise swelled louder, he rode in that direction to see for himself, and arrived to find that he had a first-class panic on his hands. Right, left, and center, his troops had given way and were fleeing in disorder. That was no blue brigade pouring through the abandoned gap, they told him. It was McClellan's entire left wing, a reinforced corps. Fortunately, they had given a good account of themselves before they broke, good enough at any rate to instill a measure of caution in their pursuers. McLaws had time to rally the fugitives and bring three more brigades down off the heights, forming a line across the valley less than 2 miles south of the Lost Gap. The day was far gone by then, the valley filled with shadows, and Franklin did not press the issue. McClellan had told him to cut off, destroy, or capture McLaws's command, and apparently he figured that the seizure of Crampton's Gap had fulfilled the first of these alternatives. Also, now that he was in McLaws's rear, he had the worry of knowing that the Confederate main body was in his. Anyhow, he decided not to be hasty. He had his men bed down for the night in line of battle. Next morning, as he was about to proceed with his advance, the rebels just ahead began to cheer. One curious bluecoat sprang up on a stone wall and called across to them, "What the hell are you fellows cheering for?" "Because Harper's Ferry has gone up, goddamn you." "I thought that was it," the Federal said, and he jumped back down again. McLaws had stood fast, and Jackson had kept the promise sent by courier to Lee 12 hours before. 1 hour of plunging fire from the surrounding heights smothered the batteries below. Soon afterwards, the white flag went up. Except for two regiments of cavalry that had escaped under cover of darkness, across the Potomac, then northward up the same road old John Brown had come south on 3 years ago next month, the whole garrison surrendered, including the men who had marched in from Martinsburg. "Our Heavenly Father blesses us exceedingly," Jackson wrote his wife, enumerating his gains. 12,520 prisoners, 13,000 small arms, 73 cannon, and a goodly haul of quartermaster stores. According to a northern reporter's "Oh my God, lay me down" reaction to his first sight of Stonewall and his men, they had great need of the latter, especially the general himself. He was dressed in the coarsest kind of homespun, seedy and dirty at that, wore an old hat which any northern beggar would consider an insult to have offered him, and in general appearance was in no respect to be distinguished from the mongrel barefooted crew who followed his fortunes. I had heard much of the decayed appearance of the rebel soldiers, but such a looking crowd! Ireland, in her worst straits, could present no parallel, and yet they glory in their shame. The captive Federals, except perhaps the Irish among them, could scarcely argue with this, but they drew a different conclusion. "Boys, he isn't much for looks," one declared, inspecting Jackson, "but if we'd had him, we wouldn't have been caught in this trap." Pleased as he was, the valley commander took little time for gloating. "Ah," he said to a jubilant companion as they stood looking at the booty, This is all very well, Major, but we have yet much hard work before us. Though he was unaware of the lost order, I thought I knew McClellan, he remarked, but this movement of his puzzles me. He was aware that Lee was being pressed, and he was eager to move to his support. 5 of the 6 divisions started for Sharpsburg that afternoon and night. The 6th was A.P. Hill's. Like Hood, once combat was at hand, he had burned to pass from the rear to the front of his division on the march to Harper's Ferry, but like Hood, he would not compromise his honor with an expression of regret. He simply requested, through a member of the staff, to be released from arrest for the duration of the fighting, after which he would report himself in arrest again. Jackson not only assented, he gave him a prominent part in the operation, and afterwards left him in charge of the place, while he himself rode off in the wake of a message he had sent Lee that morning, soon after he saw the white flag go up. Through God's blessing, Harper's Ferry and its garrison are to be surrendered. As Hill's troops have borne the heaviest part of the engagement, he will be left in command until the prisoners and public property shall be disposed of, unless you direct otherwise. The other forces can move off this evening so soon as they get their rations. That is indeed good news, Lee said when it reached him at Sharpsburg about noon. Let it be announced to the troops. McClellan's soldiers were feeling good, and so was their commander. For the first time since Williamsburg, back in early May, they were following up a battle with an advance. And as they went forward, past clumps of fallen rebels, they began to observe that their opponents were by no means the supermen they had seemed at times. Were, in fact, as one New York volunteer recorded, undersized men mostly, with sallow hatchet faces and clad in butternut, a color running all the way from a deep coffee brown up to the whitish brown of ordinary dust. He even found himself feeling sorry for them. As I looked down on the poor pinched faces, worn with marching and scant fare, all enmity died out. There was no secession in those rigid forms, nor in those fixed eyes staring blankly at the sky. They left them where they lay and pushed on down the western slope, following McClellan, whose enthusiasm not even the fall of Harper's Ferry could dampen. Though this deprived him of 12,000 reinforcements, which he thought he needed badly, it also vindicated the judgment he had shown in vainly urging the general-in-chief to order the post evacuated before Jackson rimmed the heights with guns. Moreover, though old brains could take no credit for it, his blunder had resulted in the dispersion of Lee's army, and this in turn had made possible yesterday's victory at South Mountain, as well as the larger triumph which now seemed to be within McClellan's grasp. Elated, he passed on this morning to Halleck perfectly reliable information that the enemy is making for Shepherdstown in a perfect panic, and that Lee last night stated publicly that he must admit they had been shockingly whipped. To old General Scott, in retirement at West Point, went a telegram announcing a signal victory, and informing him that his fellow Virginian and former protege had been soundly trounced. R. E. Lee in command, the rebels routed and retreating in disorder. Both reactions were encouraging. "Bravo, my dear general, twice more and it's done," Scott answered, while Lincoln himself replied to the earlier wire, "God bless you and all with you. Destroy the rebel army if possible." That was precisely what McClellan intended to do, if possible, and that afternoon, 5 miles southeast of Boonesboro, the scene of another triumphal entry and departure, he came upon a line of hills overlooking a shallow, mile-wide valley through which a rust-brown creek meandered south from its source in Pennsylvania. Antietam Creek, it was called. Beyond it, somewhat lower than the ridge on which he stood with his staff while his army filed in and spread out north and south along the line of hills outcropped with limestone, rose another ridge that masked the town of Sharpsburg, all but its spires and rooftops, and the Potomac, which followed a tortuous southward course, dividing Maryland and Virginia, another mile or so away. What interested him just now, though, was the ridge itself. There were Confederates on it, and Confederate guns, and one reason that they interested him was that they took him under fire. He sent his staff back out of range, dissolving the gaudy clot of horsemen who had drawn the fire in the first place, and went on with his study of the terrain. A mile to the right of the point where the cluster of spires and gables showed above the ridge, and facing the road that led northward along it to Hagerstown, a squat, whitewashed building was set at the forward edge of a grove of trees wearing their full late-summer foliage. The autumnal equinox was still a week away. The sunlit brick structure, dazzling white against its leafy backdrop, was a church. But it was a Dunker church and therefore had no steeple. The Dunkers believed that steeples represented vanity, and they were as much opposed to vanity as they were to war, including the one that was about to move into their churchyard. On the near side of the road, somewhat farther to the right, was another grove of trees, park-like, on the crown of the ridge, and between the two was a 40-acre field of dark green corn, man-tall and ripening for the harvest. McClellan put his glasses back in their case and retired to do some thinking. Lee had chosen his army's position with care, disposing it along the high ground overlooking the shallow valley so that its flanks were anchored at opposite ends of the 4-mile bend of the Potomac. That was his strength, but McClellan thought it might also be his weakness. Once Lee was dislodged from that ridge, with only a single ford in his rear, he might be caught in the coils of the river and cut to pieces. The problem was how to dislodge him, strong as he was. McClellan estimated yesterday's rebel casualties at 15,000 men, but that still left Lee with more than 100,000, according to McClellan, whose total strength, including Franklin, still hovering north of Harper's Ferry, was 87,164. Fortunately, however, there was no hurry. Not just yet. The army was still filing in, hot and dusty, from its march, and anyhow the day was already too far gone for an attack to succeed before darkness provided cover for a rebel getaway. He decided to work the thing out overnight. Meanwhile, the troops could get a hot meal and a good night's rest by way of preparation for whatever bloody work he designed for them to do tomorrow. Tomorrow came, September 16th, but such bloody work as it brought was done by long-range shells from batteries on those ridges east and west of the mile-wide valley with its lazy little copper-colored creek. Wanting another good look at the terrain before completing his attack plan, McClellan rose early and went to the observation post where his staff had set up headquarters. Off to the right of the Boonesboro Road and half a mile north of the center of the position, it was an excellent location, just beyond reach of the rebel guns, and there was plenty of equipment there for studying the enemy dispositions, including high-power telescopes strapped to the heads of stakes driven solidly into the ground. Unfortunately, however, these could not penetrate the thick mist that overhung the field until mid-morning. By then, the sun had burned enough of it away for McClellan to see that the Confederates had made some changes, shifting guns at various points along their line. The time consumed in noting these was well spent, he felt, for he wanted to eliminate snags and thus leave as little to chance as he possibly could. When the blow fell, he wanted it to be heavy. Noon came and went, and on both sides men lay drowsing under the press of heat, while the cannoneers continued their intermittent argument, jarring the ground and disrupting an occasional card game. By 2 o'clock, McClellan had his attack plan. Not for today, today, like yesterday, was too far gone, but for tomorrow. It was based essentially on the presence of 3 stone bridges that spanned the creek on the left, center, and right. The one on the left was closest to Sharpsburg and the enemy line. In fact, it was barely more than its own length away from the latter, since the western ridge came down sharply here, overlooking the bridge and whoever tried to use it. The center bridge, crossed by the Boonesboro Road a mile above the first, had some of the same drawbacks, being under observation from the ridge beyond, as well as some of its own growing out of the fact that it debouched onto an uphill plain that was swept by guns clustered thickly along the rebel center. The upper bridge, a mile and a half above the second, had none of these disadvantages, being well out of range of the batteries across the way. What was more, an upstream crossing would permit an unmolested march to a position astride the Hagerstown Road, well north of Lee's left flank, and a southward attack from that direction, if successful, would accomplish exactly what McClellan most desired. It would bowl the Confederates off their ridge, and, in conjunction with attacks across the other two bridges, launched when the first was underway with all its attendant confusion, expose them to utter destruction. In essence, that was McClellan's plan, the outgrowth of much poring over the landscape and the map, and now that it had been formulated, all that remained, short, that is, of the execution itself, was for him to assign the various corps their various tasks in the overall scheme for accomplishing Lee's downfall. Scrapping the previous organization into wings, he decided that Fighting Joe Hooker was the man to lead the attack down the Hagerstown Road, supported by Brigadier General J.K.F. Mansfield, who'd arrived from Washington the day before to take over Banks's corps from Williams. Sumner, too, would come down from that direction, bringing a total of three corps, half of the whole army, to bear on Lee's left flank. If that did not break him, Franklin, too, could be thrown in there. He had been summoned from Maryland Heights and was expected to arrive tomorrow morning, raising the preponderance to two-thirds. Burnside, back in command of his own corps after the death of Reno, was given the job of forcing the lower bridge and launching the direct assault on Sharpsburg, after which he would seize the Shepherdstown Ford and thus prevent the escape of even a remnant of the shattered rebel force. Porter, astride the Boonesboro Road in rear of the center bridge, would serve a double function. As the Army Reserve, his corps could be used to repulse any counterattack Lee might launch in desperation, or it could be committed to give added impetus at whatever point seemed most critical once success was fully in sight. Or else he could force the middle bridge for an uphill charge that would pierce Lee's center and chop him in two, whereupon Porter could wheel left or right to assist either Burnside or Hooker in wiping out whichever half of the rebel army survived the amputation. The battle would open at daylight tomorrow, but McClellan, after taking his staff on a fast 2-mile ride along his outpost line, drawing fire all the way from the guns across the creek, which permitted his own superior batteries emplaced along the eastern ridge to spot and pound them heavily, decided to use what was left of today in getting his men into position to launch the opening attack. Accordingly, about 4 o'clock that afternoon, Hooker's corps began its upstream crossing, the general leading the way on a high-stepping big white charger. The crossing itself was well beyond range of the rebel guns, but the line of march led near the grove of trees northeast of the Dunker Church, with the result that as the flank of the column went past that point, it struck sparks, like a file being raked across a grindstone. Hooker drew off. He wanted those woods, but not just yet, and made camp for the night in line of battle astride the Hagerstown Road, less than a mile beyond the Confederate left flank outposts. Poised to strike as soon as there was light enough for him to aim the blow, he was exactly where McClellan wanted him. So were the others, or anyhow they soon would be. Mansfield was crossing now in the darkness to be followed by Sumner. Franklin was on the way. Porter was bivouacked in an open field protected by defilade just across the Boonesboro Road from Army headquarters. Farthest south, Burnside had massed his troops in rear of the triple-arched stone bridge, which after tomorrow would bear his name. The night was gloomy, with a slow drizzle of rain and occasional sputters of musketry when the outpost men got nervous. For security reasons, the high command had forbidden fires. This was not so bad in itself. For all its dampness, the night was fairly warm, except that it kept the soldiers from boiling water. All along that dark 4-mile arc of blue-clad men, many of whom were going to die tomorrow, those who could not sleep chewed unhappily on dry handfuls of ground coffee. The sun had burned the mist away that morning, but it could not disperse the mental fog which hid from McClellan, whose eye was glued to a telescope even then across the way, the fact that Lee at the time had less than 1/5 as many troops as his opponent gave him credit for. He had, in fact, along and behind the Sharpsburg Ridge, barely 18,000 soldiers under D.H. Hill and Longstreet, fewer than were in Sumner's corps alone, until Jackson arrived at noon with 3 thin divisions, his own and Ewell's under Brigadier General J.R. Jones and Lawton, and Walker's, which had crossed the Shenandoah to join him on the march from Harper's Ferry the night before. This brought the total to 26,000 and lowered the odds to 3-1. McLaws and Anderson, still on the march, would not arrive before nightfall, and A.P. Hill was still at the ferry. He might well not arrive at all. Even if he did, so heavy had the straggling been, together with the losses at South Mountain, Lee would not be able to count on putting more than 40,000 men into his line of battle, including the cavalry and artillery, and would still face odds worse than 2-1. Aware of this, Walker expected to find Lee anxious and careworn when he joined him on the outskirts of Sharpsburg, just after noon on the 16th. "Anxious enough, no doubt he was," Walker observed, "but there was nothing in his look or manner to indicate it. On the contrary, he was calm, dignified, and even cheerful. If he had had a well-equipped army of 100,000 veterans at his back, he could not have appeared more composed and confident." His confidence was doubly based, first on the troops themselves, the hardcore men who had proved their battle prowess at Manassas and their hardiness by surviving the stony Maryland marches, and second on the advantages of the position he had established here on the ridge behind Antietam Creek. "We will make our stand on those hills," he had said as he came within sight of them at dawn of the day before. Unwilling to end his ambitious invasion campaign with the repulse just suffered at South Mountain, he crossed the shallow valley and spread his army north and south along the low western ridge. Longstreet took the right, blocking the near approach, from Sharpsburg down to the heights overlooking the lower bridge. Hill the center, posting his men along a sunken lane that crooked across the northeast quadrant formed by the intersection of the Boonesboro and Hagerstown roads, and Hood the left, occupying the woods beyond the Dunker Church. Next day, when Jackson and Walker came up, Lee sent the former to take charge of the left, joining Hood with his 2 divisions, while Walker extended Longstreet's right in order to guard the lower fords of the Antietam. The long odds were somewhat offset by the fact that he would have the interior line, with a good road well below the crest for shifting troops to threatened points along the ridge. In addition, he had the advantage of knowing that McClellan could not swing around his flanks, securely anchored as they were near the Potomac in both directions. This last, however, was also the source of some concern. Just as the river afforded the enemy no room for maneuver in his rear, so too it would afford him none in case his army was flung back off the ridge, and what was more, there was only a single ford, a mile below the former site of the Shepherdstown Bridge, which had been destroyed. He did not expect to be dislodged, but he did take the precaution of covering the ford from the Virginia side with such guns as could be spared from the reserve under Brigadier General W.N. Pendleton, his chief of artillery. That completed his preparations, until McLaws and Anderson came up. Jackson's Hills and Longstreet's 26,000 were all the troops he would have for opposing the Blue Host, whose officers were examining his dispositions from the higher ground across the valley, and whose superior guns had already begun the pounding that would make this field artillery hell for Confederate cannoneers. "Put them all in, every gun you have, long range and short range," Longstreet said to his battery commanders. But Lee had already cautioned them not to waste their limited ammunition in duels with the heavier Federal pieces. "Save it for the infantry," he told them. Hooker's upstream crossing and the resultant brush with the Texans in the woods beyond the Dunker Church gave Lee fair warning that tomorrow's first blow would be aimed at Jackson and Hood. This was not without its comforting aspect, for the men who stood in its path not only were the ones who had held the unfinished railroad against repeated assaults by Pope, but were also the ones who had led the charge that wrecked him. Perhaps they would serve Hooker the same way. However, the odds were even longer now, and as night came down, Lee's apprehension increased. He had heard nothing from McLaws and Anderson, without whom he had no reserves with which to plug a break in his line or follow up a federal repulse. Improvising as best he could, he ordered Stuart out beyond the left, hoping that he would find a position there from which to harass the flank of the attacking column, or possibly launch a distracting counterstroke. He also sent a courier to A.P. Hill, 17 miles away at Harper's Ferry, urging him to join the army with all possible speed. Whether this would get him there in time for a share in tomorrow's battle was highly doubtful, but at least Lee knew that Hill would make the effort. As Lee was about to retire for the night, conscious that he had drawn his final card in the high-stakes game of showdown he was about to play with McClellan, Hood came to report that his men were near exhaustion, having received only half a ration of beef in the past 3 days. He requested that they be withdrawn from the line to get some rest and fry some dough and bacon. Distressed though Lee was to hear that his shock brigades were enfeebled, he was obliged to admit that he had no others to put in their place. He told him to see Jackson, and while Lee turned in, the rain murmurous on the canvas, Hood left to do just that. He found him asleep under a large tree whose exposed roots made a pillow for his head. Hood nudged him awake, and when Stonewall sat up, blinking, told him what he wanted. Jackson had already rearranged his line, shifting troops around to the north and west to meet the attack he knew would come at dawn against those two stretches of woodland and the cornfield in between, but he agreed to spread them thinner in order to give Hood's hungry soldiers a chance to cook their rations, provided they were kept close at hand, ready to come running when he called. Hood agreed, and about midnight his two brigades filed southward to kindle their cook fires in the Dunker churchyard. Presently, a great stillness settled down, broken from time to time by picket firing, the individual shots coming sharp as hand claps through the mist and drizzle. All along the Sharpsburg Ridge, while their opposite numbers munched ground coffee in the encircling darkness, men who could not sleep took out their pipes and smoked and thought about tomorrow. It came in gray, with a pearly mist that shrouded the fields and woodlands, and it came with a crash of musketry backed by the deeper roar of cannon fire that mounted in volume and intensity until it was continuous, jarring the earth beneath the feet of the attackers and defenders. Hooker bore down, his three divisions in line abreast, driving the rebel pickets southward onto the high ground where the road, flanked by what now was called the East Wood and the West Wood, ran past the squat white block of the Dunker Church. That was his immediate objective, barely 1,000 yards away, though he was already taking heavy losses. Noting the glint of bayonets and the boil of smoke from the 40-acre cornfield, he called a halt while 6 of his batteries came up and began to flail the standing grain with shell and canister. Their 36 field pieces, joined presently by heavier long-range guns, pouring in a crossfire from the ridge beyond the creek. Haversacks and splintered muskets began to leap up through the dust and smoke, along with the broad-leafed stalks of corn and the dismembered heads and limbs of men. Hooker said later that every stalk in the northern and greater part of the field was cut as closely as could have been done with a knife. Yet when he got his batteries quieted and started his soldiers forward again, the fire seemed no less heavy. Entering the woods on the left and right and approaching the shattered cornfield in the center, they ran into blinding sheets of flame, and the air was quivering with bullets. Men, I cannot say fell, they were knocked out of ranks by the dozen, one survivor wrote. Still they came on, their battle flags swooping and fluttering, falling and then caught up again. The red flags of the Confederates staggered backward, and still the bluecoats came on, driving them through the blasted corn and through the early morning woods, until at last they broke and fled, their ranks too thin to rally. The Dunker Church lay dead ahead. But just as the Federals saw it within their reach, a butternut column emerged from the woods beyond it and bore down on them, yelling. At point-blank range, the rebels pulled up short, delivered a volley which one receiver said was like a scythe running through our line, and then came on again, the sunlight glinting and snapping on their bayonets. It was Hood. Jackson had called for him while his men were preparing their first hot meal in days, and perhaps that had something to do with the violence of their assault. Leaving the half-cooked food in their skillets, they formed ranks and charged the bluecoats who were responsible. Their attack was necessarily unsupported, for Jackson's and Ewell's divisions were shattered. J.R. Jones had been stunned by a shell that exploded directly above his head, and Stark, who resumed command, received 3 wounds, all mortal, within minutes. Command of the Stonewall Division passed to a colonel. Lawton was down, badly wounded, and in his 3 brigades only 2 of the 15 regimental commanders were still on their feet. But Hood took no account of this, nor did his men. Intent on vengeance, they struck the Federals north of the Dunker Church and drove them back through the cornfield, whooping and jeering, calling for them to stand and fight. They did so at the far edge of the field, forming behind their guns, and there the 2 lines engaged. With only 2,400 men in his 2 brigades, Hood knew that he would not be able to hold on long in the face of those guns, but he was determined to do what he could. When a staff officer arrived to inquire after the situation, Hood said grimly, "Tell General Jackson unless I get reinforcements I must be forced back, but I am going on while I can." His chances of going on just now were better than he knew, for though the uproar had not slacked perceptibly, Hooker had already shot his bolt. Assailed in front by the demoniacal Texans, on the right by Early's brigade moving east from its position in support of Stuart, whose guns had been tearing the flank of the blue column all along, and on the left by 2 brigades from D.H. Hill, he was forced back to the line from which he had launched his dawn assault 2 hours ago. With 2,500 of his men shot down and at least that many more in headlong flight, he was through, and he knew it. As he retreated through the shambles of the cornfield, he sent word to Mansfield that he was to bring up his corps and try his hand at completing the destruction so expensively begun. Mansfield was altogether willing. So far in the war, though he had been in charge of the bloodless occupation of Suffolk, the only real action he had seen was with the coastal batteries that took the Merrimack under fire at Hampton Roads. Now he had 2 divisions of valiant Manassas veterans, most of them unborn at the time of his West Point graduation 40 years before. He liked them, and they liked him, even on short acquaintance. A calm and dignified old gentleman, one called him, while another noted with approval that he had a proud martial air and was full of military ardor. This last, perhaps, was a result of his habit of removing his hat as he rode among them, letting his long white hair and beard stream in the wind. As a performance, it was effective, and he did it again this morning, evoking cheers from his troops as they moved forward in response to Hooker's call. "That's right, boys! Cheer!" he cried. "We're going to whip them today!" Doubling the column, he kept waving his hat and repeating his words to regiment after regiment. "Boys, we're going to lick them today!" They almost did, but not while he was with them. As they approached the East Wood, deploying for action, Hooker rode up on his white horse. "The enemy are breaking through my lines!" he shouted above the roar of guns. "You must hold this wood!" Taken aback, Mansfield watched him gallop off. He had thought Hooker was driving the graybacks handsomely and that his own corps had been summoned to complete the victory. By now his lead regiments had reached a rail fence at the near edge of a field just short of the woods, and he saw to his horror that they had spread along it and were shooting at figures that moved in the shadows of the trees. "You are firing at our own men!" he cried. As soon as he got them stopped, he leaped his horse over the fence, intending to ride ahead and see for himself. "Those are rebels, General," a soldier yelled. Mansfield pulled up, leaning forward to peer into the shadows. "Yes, you're right," he said, and as he spoke, his words were confirmed by a volley that came crashing out of the woods, crippling his horse. He dismounted and walked back to the fence, but as he tried to climb over it, moving with the terrific deliberation of an old man among young ones, a bullet struck him in the stomach. He went down, groaning. Three veterans, who saw in the wounded general a one-way ticket out of chaos, took him up and lugged him back to an aid station, where a flustered surgeon half-strangled him with a jolt of whiskey, and presently he died. Williams resumed command of the corps and sent both divisions forward, swinging one to the right so that its advance swept through the cornfield. Hood's survivors were knocked back, yielding ground and losing a stand of colors for the first time in their brief, furious history. On the bluecoats came, a Massachusetts colonel waving the captured Texas flag. They followed the route Hooker's men had taken an hour ago, and, like them, were stopped within reach of the Dunker Church by a two-brigade counterstroke. Jackson had called for reinforcements at the height of the first attack, and Lee had sent Walker's division from the right flank to the left, taking a chance that the Federals would not storm the lower Antietam crossings. These two North Carolina brigades arrived too late to contest the first penetration, but they got there in time to meet the second at its climax. Like Hooker's, Mansfield's men were stopped. However, they did not fall back. They stayed where they were, and Williams sent word to headquarters that if he could be reinforced, he would have the battle won. Reinforcements were already on the way, three divisions of them under Sumner, whose corps was the largest in the army. But they came by a different route, not down the Hagerstown Road or parallel to it, but at an angle through the lower fringes of the East Wood, which had been cleared of all but dead or dying rebels. So far, the close-up fighting had been left to troops formerly under Pope. Now McClellan's own were coming in, led by the man who had saved the day at Fair Oaks. Dragoon style, Sumner rode at the head of his lead division, leaving the others to come along behind. As he emerged from the woods, he saw to his right the wreckage of the cornfield, and up ahead the Dunker Church, dazzling white through rifts in the smoke boiling up from the line which Mansfield's men were struggling to hold against Walker's counterstroke. As Sumner saw it, the thing to do was get there fast before that line gave way. With what his corps historian later called ill-regulated ardor, he kept the lead division in march formation, three brigades close-packed in as many files, moving southwest across the open stretch of ground between the East Wood and the church. It was then that he was struck, two-thirds of the way back down the column and squarely on the flank, with results that were sudden and altogether murderous. Too tightly wedged to maneuver as a unit or even dodge as individuals, men fell in windrows, the long files writhing like wounded snakes. More than 2,000 of them were shot down within a quarter of an hour. "My God, we must get out of this!" Sumner cried. His soldiers thought so too, scrambling frantically for the rear as the graybacks charged. It was McLaws. When his and Anderson's divisions finally reached Sharpsburg about 7 o'clock that morning, incredibly, they had been delayed at the outset because the paroled Federals, impatient to get home from Harper's Ferry, had clogged the bridge leading northward across the Potomac to the foot of Maryland Heights. More time was lost in a search for Lee, who was away from headquarters inspecting his right and center, while Hooker was hammering at his left. When they found him nearly an hour later, he sent Anderson to reinforce Hill and McLaws to reinforce Jackson, who by then was receiving the full force of Mansfield's attack. This, too, had been stopped by the time McLaws got there, but just as he came over the ridge, he saw Sumner's lead division emerge from the East Wood, driving straight for the Dunker Church with its flank exposed. He struck it, wrecked it, and took up the pursuit with his four brigades, joined on the left by Walker and Early, who threw Williams into retreat as well. Hooker by now was one of the nearly 7,000 casualties the Federals had suffered at this end of the field. He rode northward out of the fight, dripping blood from a wounded foot, and his men followed, along with Mansfield's and Sumner's, to reform beyond the line of guns from which they had taken off at dawn. In rapid sequence, two whole corps and part of a third, six divisions containing 31,000 men, had been shattered and repulsed. Jackson's losses had been comparable, probably in excess of 5,000, which represented a larger percentage of casualties than he had inflicted. But he was strangely elated. Looking out over the shambles of the cornfield, which had just changed hands for the fourth time that morning, and which by now was so thickly carpeted with dead men that one witness claimed you could walk in any direction across it and never touch the ground, his pale blue eyes had a fervent light to them. "God has been very kind to us this day," he said. For the first time since daylight glimmered across the eastern ridge, his lines were free of pressure, and so was he himself. Sitting his horse in the yard of the Dunker Church, he ate a peach while his medical director submitted a preliminary casualty report. Stonewall made no comment except a remark between bites that it was heavy, but when the surgeon expressed the fear that the survivors were too badly shaken to withstand another assault, he shook his head, apparently unconcerned, and pointed in the direction of the bluecoats huddled behind their line of guns a mile to the north. "Dr. McGuire, they have done their worst," he said. He was right, so far as concerned the left. The Federals there had done their worst and best. But Sharpsburg was, in effect, three battles, piled one on top of another. And just as the first had ended with the repulse of Sumner's lead division, so did the second open with the repulse of the other two. Recovering his balance in the midst of disaster, the old man rode back through the woods in search of the rest of his corps, which was missing. One division he found had failed to cross the creek on schedule, while the other had lost contact and veered south, coming upon an eroded country lane from which a zigzag line of graybacks loosed a close-up volley that shattered the lead brigade and sent the others scrambling back. The third division, coming up at last, received the same reception and gave ground, but presently rallied and formed a line on which the second rallied, too. And thus no sooner was Jackson's battle over than Hill's got under way. Here along the center, the Confederates occupied what amounted to an entrenched position, the only one on the field. For the lane was not only worn below the level of the ground, affording them a considerable measure of protection, but it also ran between snake rail fences, and they had dismantled the outer fence to make a substantial breastworks of the rails. What was more, the crest of the ridge was just over 100 yards forward and uphill, so that the bluecoats could not see what they had to face until they were practically upon it, within easy musket range and outlined target sharp against the eastern sky. This was unnerving, to say the least, and to make matters worse, psychologically at any rate, the rebels jeered and hooted at the dark-clothed attackers coming over the rise, silhouetted against the glare of sunlight. "Go away, you black devils! Go home!" they yelled as they loosed their volleys. They felt confident and secure, and so did Hill, for a time at least. But as the Federals continued to press their attack with increasing persistency and numbers, Sumner had more than 12,000 men in his remaining two divisions, while Hill himself had less than 7,000, even after Anderson's arrival, the issue began to grow doubtful. Then, presently, as a result of two unforeseen mishaps, it grew worse than doubtful. It grew impossible. The first of these was that Anderson was severely wounded and carried from the field, command of his division passing to the senior brigadier, long-haired Roger Pryor, who by now had proved that his reluctance to fire the first shot at Fort Sumter had not proceeded from a lack of nerve, but whose talents were still primarily oratorical. From that time on, the division no longer functioned as a unit, and in fact went out of existence except as a loose collection of regiments and companies, each one fighting on its own as it saw fit. Which perhaps was just as well in the end, for that was what happened to Hill's division, too, though its commander emerged unscathed from the experience of having three horses shot from under him in rapid succession. This second disintegration was a result of the second mishap, which occurred when the brigade on the left, receiving the order to refuse its threatened flank, misunderstood the command and pulled out altogether, whereupon the opposing Federals hurried forward, occupied the abandoned portion of the line, and began to lay down an enfilading fire, which gave the sunken road the name it bore thereafter, Bloody Lane. What had been a sheltered position, one from which to hoot at charging Yankees and shoot them down when they were so unmissably close that their faces filled the gun sight, became a trap. Quite suddenly, as if they had tumbled headlong by the hundreds out of the sky, dead men filled whole stretches of the road to overflowing. Horrified, unit by unit, from left to right, the survivors broke for the rear. And now it was the Yankees doing the hooting and the shooting. Faced with the abrupt disintegration of the isolated center, the exploitation of which would mean the end of Lee's army, Hill did what he could to rally the fugitives streaming back across the ridge, and though few of them had a mind for anything but their present dash for safety, he managed to scrape together a straggler line along the outskirts of Sharpsburg. While these men were delivering a sporadic fire against the Bluecoats, who were massing along the sunken road, apparently preparing to continue their advance, Hill sent an urgent call for guns and reinforcements. There were none of the latter to send him. The right had been stripped, and the left had been fought to exhaustion. But Longstreet had seen the trouble and was already sending every cannon he could lay hands on. He had not wanted to fight this battle in the first place, or for that matter, the odds being what they were, any battle in which there was so little to gain and so very much to lose. But now that it was unavoidably underway, he gave it everything he had. Limping about in carpet slippers and gesturing with an unlighted cigar, he ordered gun crew after gun crew to put their pieces in action along the ridge where Hill was forming his thin new line. As fast as these guns came into the open, the powerful Union batteries took them under fire from across the way, exploding caissons and mangling cannoneers. Observing one section of guns whose fire was weak because there were too few survivors to serve them properly, Old Pete dismounted his staff and improvised two high-ranking gun crews, himself holding their horses and correcting the ranges while they fired. Hill, meanwhile, had been watching the Bluecoats down in the sunken road. He believed they were about to attack him. Such an attack would surely be successful, weak as he was, and the only way he knew to delay it was to attack them first. However, when he called along his line for volunteers, there was no answer, until presently one man said he would go if Hill would lead. Quickly taking him up on that, Hill seized a rifle and started forward with a shout, joined by about 200 others who were persuaded by his example. The attack was brief, in fact it was repulsed almost as soon as it began, but Hill believed it served its purpose. Here, opposite the denuded Confederate center, the Federals stayed where they were for the rest of the day. According to Hill, this was either because he had frightened them into immobility, or else it was an outright miracle. It was neither, unless it was something of both. What it really was Sumner and McClellan. Franklin had come up by now, and though he had left one division on Maryland Heights, he still brought more than 8,000 soldiers onto the field. One brigade had shared in the fight on the right, and now he wanted to use the other five in an assault on the gray line beyond the sunken road. But Sumner stopped him. The old man's corps had lost 5,100 men today, more than Hooker's and Mansfield's combined. Apparently, he had seen enough of killing north of the Dunker Church and here in front of Bloody Lane. The 39-year-old Franklin tried to argue, but Sumner, who not only outranked him but was also nearly twice his age, kept insisting that the army was on the verge of disintegration, and that another repulse would mean catastrophe. Presently a courier arrived from McClellan, bringing a suggestion that the attack be pressed by both commands, if possible. Sumner, to whom, except for his long pointed nose, old age had given the glaring look of a death's head, turned on him and cried hotly, "Go back, young man, and tell General McClellan I have no command. Tell him my command, Banks's command, and Hooker's command are all cut up and demoralized. Tell him General Franklin has the only organized command on this part of the field." When McClellan received this message, he came down off the hill and crossed the creek to see for himself the situation in the center. Sumner and Franklin presented their arguments, and now that he had a close-up view of the carnage, McClellan sided with the senior. He told them both to hold what had been won, Then he rode back across the creek. It was now about 2 o'clock, and the second battle, which, like the first, had lasted about 4 hours, was over. The third was about to begin. In a broader sense, it had already been going on for as long as the other two combined. That is, the opponents had been exchanging shots across the lower reaches of the creek since dawn. But so far, all that had come of this was the maiming of a few hundred soldiers, most of them in blue. Despite McClellan's repeated orders, including one sent at 9 o'clock directing that the crossing be effected at all hazards, not a man out of the nearly 14,000 enrolled in Burnside's 4 divisions had reached the west bank of the Antietam by the time the sun swung past the overhead. "McClellan appears to think I am not trying my best to carry this bridge," the rough-whiskered general said testily to a staff colonel his friend the army commander sent to prod him. "You are the third or fourth one who has been to me this morning with similar orders." As he spoke, he sat his horse beside a battery on a hilltop, looking down at the narrow, triple-arched stone span below. He watched it with a fascination amounting to downright prescience, as if he knew already that it was to bear his name and be, in fact, his chief monument, no matter what ornate shafts of marble or bronze a grateful nation might raise elsewhere in his honor. So complete was his absorption by the bridge itself, he apparently never considered testing the depth of the water that flowed sluggishly beneath it. If he had, he would have discovered that the little copper-colored stream, less than 50 feet in width, could have been waded at almost any point without wetting the armpits of the shortest man in his corps. However, except for sending 1 division downstream in search of a local guide to point out a ford that was rumored to exist in that direction, he remained intent on effecting a dry-shod crossing. Admittedly, this was no easy matter. The road came up from the southeast, paralleling the creek for a couple of 100 yards, and then turned sharply west across the bridge, where it swung north again to curve around the heights on the opposite bank. Just now, those heights were occupied by rebels, many of them highly skilled as marksmen, though at that range skill was practically superfluous, which meant that whoever exposed himself along that road in the shadow of those heights was likely to catch a faceful of bullets. Nevertheless, this was the only route Burnside could see, and he kept sending men along it regiment by regiment, intermittently all morning, with predictable results. Observing from across the way the ease with which this lower threat was being contested, Lee all this time had been stripping his right of troops in order to strengthen his hard-pressed left and center. By noon he was down to an irreducible skeleton force, so that presently, when he learned that Hill had lost the sunken road and was calling in desperation for reinforcements, he had none to send him. Like Hill in this extremity, knowing that he probably could not withstand an assault, he decided that his only recourse was to deliver one, preferably on the left, which had been free of heavy pressure for 2 hours. Accordingly, he sent word for Jackson to attack the Federal right, if possible, swinging it back against the river. Stonewall was delighted at the prospect and set out at once to reconnoiter the ground in that direction. "We'll drive McClellan into the Potomac," he said fervently. Back at Sharpsburg, meanwhile, Lee was doing what little he could to make this possible. When the captain of a shattered Virginia battery reported with his few surviving men, he instructed him to join Jackson for the proposed diversion. One of the smoke-grimed cannoneers spoke up, "General, are you going to send us in again?" Lee saw then that it was Robert. "Yes, my son," he told him, "you all must do what you can to help drive these people back." The battery left, heading northward, but no such attack was delivered. Reconnoitering, Stonewall found the Union flank securely anchored to the east bank of the river and well protected by massed artillery. He had to abandon his hopes for a counterstroke. "It is a great pity," he said regretfully. "We should have driven McClellan into the Potomac." By the time Lee learned that the proposed attack could not be delivered, that no diversion to relieve the pressure against the sagging center would be made. The urgent need for it had passed. Hill's thin line, along which, in accordance with his instructions, now that his feeble 200-man charge had been repulsed, the color-bearers flourished their tattered battle flags, hiding his weakness behind gestures of defiance, went unchallenged by the bluecoats massed along the sunken road. But Lee was not allowed even a breathing space in which to enjoy the relaxation of tension. Catastrophe, it seemed, was still with him, had in fact merely withdrawn in order to loom up elsewhere. Immediately on the heels of the news that the Federal advance had stalled in front of the center, word came from the right that the contingency most feared had come to pass. Burnside was across the bridge at last. Robert Toombs was in command there, holding the heights with three slim Georgia regiments against four Federal divisions. Lately, just as previously he had wearied of his cabinet post, he had been feeling disenchanted with the military life. Exasperated now as then by the obtuseness of those around him, he had decided to resign his commission, but not before he had distinguished himself in some great battle. "The day after such an event," he wrote his wife, "I will retire if I live through it." Such an event was now at hand, and he had been in his glory all that morning, successfully challenging with 550 men the advance of more than 20